This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I do worry about the world kind of breaking down into a fossil block versus a renewable block, you know, sort of the old Cold War, but along the lines of energy.
While U.S. political news is certainly more than depressing these days, it's always nice to get a healthy reminder of the many good things that are happening around us. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Inside Climate News science reporter Bob Berwin as he prepares to cover next month's COP30 conference in Brazil. We look at some of the more positive developments on the biodiversity and rewilding fronts, examine the effectiveness of some recent policies to help animal populations like seabirds and gray wolves bounce back, and talk about what to expect from the upcoming COP30 conference. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bob Berwin. He is a science reporter for Inside Climate News. Bob, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Nice to visit with you again, Alex.
So you've been covering the COP conferences for Inside Climate News for several years now. You're on the cusp of heading to Belém, Brazil to cover COP30. But I wanted to catch you before you went to talk about some of the pieces that you've been writing over the years chronicling efforts to restore wilderness and biodiversity. Why don't we start with something pretty close to me here in San Francisco, some of the efforts to restore seabird populations. You focus on the Farallon Islands, which I, on a clear day, can see from a hilltop not far from my home.
Yeah. I lived near there as well for a while at Point Monterey, and I could also see the Farallons on clear days. There were not a lot of clear days where I lived because there was a lighthouse there. We were in the fog zone. But as I read some of these studies about seabird restoration, it also made me recall that view and made me see that little cluster of islands in a whole new light as islands of biodiversity that encompassed not only, the sharks that were famed in the area when I lived there, but as a whole complex ecosystem that includes the birds that nested there for a long, long time, algae that and phytoplankton that bloom in the water as winter rains wash the guano for the birds down into the water and feed these nutrients that in turn feed fish that then attract, again, the famed Farallon sharks. The story of the Farallon Islands also made me realize how strong of an impact human activities have had on, well, all sorts of species, but seabirds. There's some estimates that in the last couple of hundred years, the total global seabird population was cut by 90%. So, you know, imagine 90% more birds than you see now. And you still see large flocks and swarms of birds sometimes. But at times, some of the early voyagers and explorers just talked about these flocks of seabirds that darkened the sky for a few hours. And all these birds landed somewhere and they pooped into the ocean and fed an incredibly more carbon-rich ecosystem, both going up and down. So storing carbon in the bottom of the ocean and releasing nutrients for other animals to eat. So it's sort of a biological carbon pump that is in some ways triggered by bird poop.
So I knew that the Farallon Islands were kind of just covered in bird poop. They're like guano central, but I had no idea that it was such a thriving seabird colony. You write that it was the largest single seabird nesting colony in the United States. At its height, you write that the MER population dropped from 400,000 to 60,000 in just a few decades during the gold rush, as people harvested up to 500,000 eggs per year. That's crazy. So people were sailing out to the Farallones in the 1850s and 60s and harvesting seabird eggs in mass.
Exactly. And this was happening, obviously, other places in the world as well. You know, perhaps in earlier eras, more still in sort of hunting, gathering, foraging times, maybe it was done somewhat sustainably by smaller populations. And the guano itself was exploited and was part of the, you know, part of colonialization. People were brutalized and enslaved to force them to harvest guano from distant islands so it could be transported as fertilizer to developed countries, colonial countries. At the same time, they, you know, they got the eggs too and hunted the birds for food. And this is what led to this decimation, along with habitat destruction and pollution and other impacts like that, or loss of other related habitat, you know, birds that maybe nest in part marshlands and then fly to the sea. Although generally in this article, we're talking specifically about seabirds that really spend almost their entire life at sea and are only on land for a few months to nest and breed and fledge perhaps. And the rest of the time they're out flying or in the water. And so I try to describe them as this huge biological carbon pump that really helps cycle nutrients through the ocean and ultimately ends up in more carbon-rich sediment falling to the bottom of the ocean and being held there more or less stable long-term as part of the Earth's natural carbon cycles before our emissions disrupted that.
It's pretty crazy to think that humans were so short-sighted, even in, you know, 150 years ago, thinking that they could just take all the eggs of this bird and it would just be this infinite supply of protein for them.
I don't think they thought about it very much. And I mean, honestly, in a lot of cases, unfortunately, we still see that, you know, that mentality of exploitation. I mean, it's definitely gotten better. And there are efforts to do specifically seabird restorations. And there are studies about which methods are most successful, how to lure birds back to an island, how to, you know, rear them in laboratories and ensure the success when you let them go. There's a lot of scientists who work on specifically on restoration biology. And this could be really important of sort of a post-carbon future for, you know, a post-carbon future for humanity, for countries, for the globe, in which we focus more on restoring some of these really just critical for life systems that are breaking down right now, clearly, and that at some point we'll need to repair. And that's why it is being acknowledged in, you know, the European Union, 28 countries in Europe recently passed a nature restoration law that sets specific targets for really for aggressively restoring wetlands and rivers. And yeah, there's a lot of political bickering around the fringes of it. What are the deadlines and who's going to enforce it? Still, there's quite widespread agreement that and recognition that this is important and that each country should pursue these things as it can to heal natural ecosystems that ultimately sustain human life too.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News. So, Bob, we were talking about seabird restoration, but now let's talk about some other animals. Rewilding is a buzzword in the environmental space. You've written about restoring not only fish, but bison, wolves, and other animals that are at risk. Why don't you give us some bullet points of the efforts that really stand out to you and give you hope moving forward?
Yeah, again, being a science reporter, when I see a series of new studies coming out that all show that restoring ecosystems and species can have a big climate benefit at a relatively reasonable cost, I start to think, yeah, this sounds better than trying to build a bunch of giant machines that can suck carbon dioxide out of the air. Let's restore some of these biological carbon pumps at sea with seabirds and whales, and on land with ecosystems and species. And as you mentioned, I wrote about a study in 2023 where, you know, a group of leading scientists were able to calculate specifically the climate or carbon benefits of different scales of restoration. And they looked at not just one single species, but groups of species that were once common in North America, bison, beaver, wolves, and suggested that, you know, creating good interconnected habitat and numbers of those species and good self-sustaining populations could really draw down a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and again, start to sort of put it into a solid form in land where it's not heating up the climate.
Yes, and you're talking about these like carbon capture technologies that just are not proven. While we know that things like trying to protect beaver ponds and to try to help vegetation in critical areas where these animals will be able to flourish are proven methods.
Right. You could measure if you restore 100 acres of forest with a certain type of tree, you could measure and project how much carbon that will store over 10, 20, 50, 100 years. It may be a little bit harder to measure with a really dynamic ecosystem, something like changing beaver ponds. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because I have written about that a couple of times. And I've also seen now studies coming out, wait a minute, actually, wow, there's a lot of emissions coming from all these new beaver ponds up in the Arctic. We might need to recalibrate some of this info. So, you know, again, but then those are single pieces. But when you look at things like this 2023 study, which incorporated, you know, fish and mammals on land, and it just becomes really clear with solid scientific evidence that doing things like this on a large scale would take massive amounts of CO2 out of the air.
Yes, and we look at things like wolves coming back in California or wherever as nice stories, but ultimately they can be more indicative of larger efforts and more of a systemic change. And these kind of efforts don't just take place in a vacuum.
Right. I mean, there's a sort of a growing network of restoration efforts. And yeah, and again, there aren't any studies showing that this would not be a good idea. Let's put it that way. You know, there's nobody out there saying like, oh no, we should actually pave over more, you know, of this meadow because that would be good for the climate. So it seems a pretty clear-cut path forward, and something that countries can pursue individually, as is foreseen under, you know, climate agreements like the Paris Agreement, or collectively in groups like the European Union, where they can work cross-border to, you know, to try and cover larger areas.
You're there in Europe, based in Austria. What are some of the trends in biodiversity restoration that you're following?
One interesting project that I I've had an eye on for quite a while is pretty widespread efforts to protect areas that were already wild, because it's always easier to protect something that already exists than to try and recreate it. So that's another interesting part of the context for this discussion, because there are a lot of good places that are still getting destroyed. But here in Europe, in Austria specifically, there's an initiative called the Green Band, which is working along thousands of miles of what used to be the border between the Soviet bloc and the Western Europe, from Scandinavia all the way down to the Balkans and through Central Europe too. That border is about 20 miles from where I live. And there happens to be a major green belt center there, so I've been there quite a bit, and have tracked efforts to ensure that wildlife can get across the border into good, healthy forest on both sides, because there was sort of a border zone there that was never developed because it was a Cold War going on and there were troops on both sides. Another encouraging thing that I've seen related to this is that about the same time that I moved to Austria in 2015, Austria was also recolonized. Actually, that's not even the right word. Native wolves moved back into Austria for the first time in about 200 years.
Put that in context, if you can.
It means that there has been enough effort to preserve habitat in nature, to allow wolves to reoccupy areas where they historically lived for thousands of years before they were, extirpated by human hunters. And that human tolerance for their existence in that space has grown. And so one wolf came in, and in the 10 years since then, the population here in Austria has got up to, I think, somewhere between 40 and 50. There's several different packs, and they're kind of living pretty conflict free. I mean, they do kill a sheep every now and then, but considering how densely populated and small Austria is, it seems quite an amazing restoration without any effort by anybody. They basically came themselves.
What kind of populations are we talking about?
I think there's the latest estimate I saw was about 40 to 50 wolves since, starting with one back in 2015. It wasn't clear at all when they first started moving back in what the reaction would be, but I'm encouraged also by the fact that, and I have contact with, people who live in the area where the most wolves are and are farmers up there and whatever, and they're not really worried or anything. They're going like, yeah, it's just another thing. I'd rather deal with the wolves than the politicians in Vienna,
I just want to talk to you. I won't do you no harm. I just want to know about your different lives on this here people farm. I hear some of you have families in cages, tall and cold. Some just sit there and dust away past the age of old. But is this true? Please let me talk to you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News. Bob, you're talking about dealing with politicians versus dealing with wolves. As I mentioned earlier, you cover the COP conferences for Inside Climate News. You're about to go to Brazil. Why don't you give us a recap of some of the biodiversity efforts that have been made in recent COP conferences?
I think I have to start with the COP a couple of years ago, where I think for the first time there was sort of this universal recognition that climate and biodiversity will never be solved as two separate issues. And I'm starting with that because I want to focus on the climate biodiversity connection and this growing realization. I think we've known, since Edmund O. Wilson how important biodiversity is, and we shouldn't even be talking about if it's important or not. It's how do we support it? How do we integrate it with all this other stuff that's going on? So a couple of years ago in Dubai, they really emphasized that aspect of it. And now as a result, we see a few countries, one specifically Panama, where I interviewed one of their climate negotiators recently. When they submit their new pledge to the COP conference this year, it will include not just an emissions or a global warming target, but it will encompass biodiversity and other aspects of conservation, like plastics pollution. So they're going to say, look, we realize we can't just hand in a paper saying we're going to cut emissions by X percent, but we realize at the same time we have to talk about how we can use nature to achieve this, what the problems are, what the challenges are with that, how it's related to plastics production. Why we can't invest in new fossil fuel if we want to meet this target. We have to put all this together into one sort of plan.
Where are you hoping to see some efforts set forth in Brazil in the upcoming COP30 from a biodiversity perspective?
Well, I think with the COP being held in the Amazon region, which is a high biodiversity area, and statements leading up to the COP by the president of Brazil, President Lula, that biodiversity should be high on the agenda. I hope that people will talk about it and that they may adopt some initial or some additional action items, or implement some previous measures that they've suggested. But I also feel like we invest a lot of expectation into each COP as sort of a summit that's going to deliver, some new groundbreaking agreement, and it's not really intended as that. And those are kind of misplaced expectations. The culmination of the COP process was the Paris Agreement, and the subsequent meetings are really about implementing that. And a lot of the other stuff that surrounds each COP meeting is really sort of a distraction from the main goal of getting countries to submit and then implement national plans that add up to bringing us to net zero, so we could stop the increase in greenhouse gas emissions. So, if they set a specific target that every country commits to restore biodiversity by a certain year, and it's enshrined as something enforceable, it would be great. But it's not the way it happens. And there have been promises related to COP, like the 30% of land, 30% of ocean ecosystems preserved by 2030. That's not a formal agreement under COP that is legally binding in any way. It's just another one of those announcements that world leaders tend to make to make everybody feel like a lot got done at the COP meeting, and then it just sort of fades away and not that much happens, unfortunately.
And I can imagine that the underlying basis that must be in the back of a lot of people's minds is the fact that the world's leading economy has pretty much tossed aside any kind of environmental efforts, and the United States is anything but a leader.
Yeah, I think it is. And obviously we're probably not going to see a whole lot of nationally led, coordinated nature restoration efforts in the US. In fact, there are efforts to roll back protections, and some habitat is going to be lost, sage grouse potentially. There are some species that may go extinct because they're so close to the brink because of this particular time in US politics. As far as in the global picture, I think yes, the US is on everybody's mind. It was at the last COP, which was right after the election, so it was a very fresh wound. And with the worst insults yet to come, the worst pain yet to come. I do also think there's been sort of a drawing together and reshifting among the rest of the world. There are concerns about the US leaning on other countries and strong-arming them and trying to force Europe to buy more fossil gas, for example, ship from, huge new terminals in the US and, maybe even actively trying to push countries further down the path of fossil dependency. But I see a lot of global resistance to that too, and there are countries that there's just no way they're ever going to start doing more fossil fuels because they've already leapfrogged past that into, electric vehicles and battery storage. And I would say the really high level global consensus is that the Paris Agreement from the COP 10 years ago really signaled that this transition was going to happen. It never set any specific targets for emissions. It set a temperature target and said, let's see how we get there. Everybody understood it meant reducing emissions, which means transforming energy systems. And that transformation is underway globally, and it's not going to be held up. It may be, I don't know if you could even measure it. And I think the rest of the world will rally and move forward with decarbonization, with the exception of a few fossil states, which the US has actually sadly always kind of been part of anyway, as a huge not only fossil producer, but fossil consumer. So it's not that new of a constellation. I do worry about the world kind of breaking down into a fossil block versus a renewable block, sort of the old Cold War, but along the lines of energy. And, in a situation like that, potential conflicts over the thawing Arctic region and even Antarctica for resources, if it really starts becoming more accessible, that's still pretty far-fetched right now, but it's being eyed, also for marine resources. There are concerns about Chinese krill harvest in around Antarctica. And so, yeah, I mean, climate politics have always been part of global geopolitics, I think.
Well, I highly recommend our listeners continue to follow your work on Inside Climate News. Bob Berwin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. Always a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wayne Shorter, Neil Young, and Ricky Lee Jones. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.